Jesus, and I.
All right, anyway, he talks about, he's a famous writer of a book called World Religions, and he talks about seeing Orthodox Jew in Israel davening, and a Buddhist monk meditating, and so forth, and a Muslim prostrating himself towards Mecca 5 times a day. And he sees all of these as sort of approaches toward the ultimate, or toward God. And it's kind of a simple or low-level thinking to think of other great religions as kind of the enemy. I don't think they're the enemy. They're come from different cultures and different epochs of history. And they are ways that maybe God revealed himself to human beings. After speaking about those different religious people, he says, "What a strange fellowship this is, the God seekers in every land lifting their voices in the most disparate ways to the God of all life. How does it sound from above? Like bedlam, or do the strains blend into a strange ethereal harmony? Does one faith carry the lead?" This kind of, it seems, there is a kind of sometimes arrogance within different religious traditions that theirs is the true religion. How do they determine that they happen to be born into the true religion? In any event, does one faith carry the lead, or do the parts share in a counterpoint and antiphony where, not in full if not in full-throated chorus, we cannot know. All we can do is to try to listen carefully and with full attention to each voice in turn as it addresses the divine. All we can do is to try to listen carefully and with full attention to each voice as it addresses the divine." And he says that religion alive confronts the individual with the most momentous option life can present. It is the call of the soul to the highest adventure it can undertake. They propose journeying across the jungles, peaks, and deserts of the human spirit. The call is to confront reality, to master the self. I just want to give you some statistics. How many people are there on the earth now? About 5 billion? Who knows that for sure? I think it's about 5 billion, isn't it? It was about 3 billion when I was in high school. I think it's about 5 billion now. In any event, the statistics that Houston Smith gives is that Christians are 24%, so you have a very substantial percentage. Muslims, so 20 of them, about 1 in 4 people who are born into Christian families and identify themselves as Christians. I don't know about true Christians, they may be a few. But Muslims are 14%. That's a very large number. And I'm giving a talk Saturday evening at 6:50 or something on the Islam. Hindus are a very substantial percentage, 12.6%. Hinduism is the predominant religion of India, although they have some Buddhism there, Jainism, and other lesser known religions, some Christians probably. Buddhists, whom I talked about yesterday, are 6.3%. Jews, and I'm Jewish by birth, only 0.4, in other words, less than 1%, about less than 0.5%, but had a great influence as a kind of mother religion of Christianity and Islam. And then others, this is an interesting statistic, and this was before the fall of the Soviet Union, and the others, non-religious, Marxists, humanists, atheists, and so on, 42.7%. So and that was at least back when those statistics were made, although there's set to be some religious revivals in the, to some extent, in the former communist countries. But so it's almost like a one and two. So I think that the real option to religion or approach to the spirit, whatever that is, the great spirit, the Native Americans call it, is non-belief or materialism, atheism. So I think that that's the real one. Sure. religion goes very, very far back in India. Hinduism is not a simple religion, but a very complex series of developments that kind of demonstrates maybe some universal religious developments in all cultures. This is my book, by the way, Physicians of the Soul, which is on six world religions. And that's, I have a chapter on Krishna, who is a god figure, god incarnation in Hinduism. This is the second book I wrote, Cosmic Consciousness Revisited, which has to do with psychologies of religion. Back to Hinduism. Let me play you a little Hindu music from the Shivananda Yoga Ashram in Val-Marin, Quebec, that have a Hindu Swami as their leader, their Swami Vishnu Devananda. Yes. Animistic religion, that is the idea of a spirit in all things, and I think that's true too. And then following them came the Austric peoples, and they were agricultural, went from kind of a Stone Age people to a agricultural people, and agricultural peoples of the New Stone Age tended to have feminine goddesses, the Mother Earth and all. And they had a myth, the Austric peoples, that the world was born from an egg. The question is, who laid the egg? following them were the Dravidian peoples, and they were peoples who migrated to India from the Mediterranean areas, and they developed zoomorphic religion with the animal deities like the elephant-headed god Ganesha. And when you go to like yoga ashram with a Hindu Swami, all stages of the Hindu religion tend to come in. Like they chant the chant to Ganesha, the elephant-headed god. It goes, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Parima, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Jaya Ganesha, Parima. Anyway, and they would have a elephant figure. So it's a very complex development, and that's the third stage of it. And then somewhere around 1500 BC, somewhat after the time of Abraham, before the time of Moses, an Aryan peoples from the northwest, so European sources, came down, lighter-skinned people, came down to India, and somewhat of an invasion, somewhat of a settlement, and they, it was from them that the Vedas came, and the Vedas, there are four of them, were no more zoomorphic religion, but a polytheistic religion with, I think, 33 deities, 33 gods and goddesses called Devas. These were Vedas. And the Vedas are still sacred within Hinduism. They are the Rig Veda, the Sam Veda, the Yajur Veda, and the Atharva Veda. And these tend to be male and female gods of superhuman power, but they represent various forces of nature. Some examples of them are Ajna, the god of fire, Surya, the sun god, Ushas, the goddess of the dawn, Yama, the god of death, and so forth. And each of these four Vedas tended to have a separate priesthood for each Veda, and worship was to try to cull favor for health and life and prosperity or getting food and so forth from the various gods and goddesses. They had a creation hymn. The Rig Veda is called the Hymn of Creation, and in this there's some seeking for the original source of everything. It's not as definitive as our Bible. In the beginning, I'm in the Hindu mode now, so I forgot that. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Right. But here, from the Rig Veda, here it is, non-being then was not, even non-being was not, this is in the beginning here, nor was there being. There was no realm of air, no sky above it. What covered them? And where? In whose protection? And where was the deep, unfathomable water? Death then existed not, nor the immortal. This is time before the beginning. There none of night and day. Breathless that one breathed of its own nature. Aside from that was nothing whatsoever. There was darkness, hidden darkness at the outset, an unillumined flood. Indeed was all this, that creative force covered by the void. That one was born by the power of brooding. This is kind of in our scientific myths, we have now the myth of the Big Bang, 15 or 20 billion years ago, but what was before the Big Bang? This is kind of wondering about that. Yes?
Does this religion predate the Scandinavian and Greek mythologies, or is it about the same time?
About 1500 to it. Greek, the Bronze Mycenaean Age of Greece was about 1200 BC, so there's some overlap, early ancient Greece that Homer talks about. There's some overlap with that, yeah.
Has anyone ever established any connection between this religion?
No, let me point out that they had 33 gods and goddesses. The ancient Greek pantheon had 12. Yeah, that's another question. Carl Jung would look at those as archetypes of the collective unconscious and say that they're kind of, these are things that come from human nature rather than spreading from one to the other. That's two different points of view. Some don't believe in that, and I think it's just, but I don't think there's too much connection between those. Let me correct myself. I'll give you that to research. In my class, I have a class in comparative religion at Merrillhurst College in Oregon, Lake Oswego, Oregon, and one of my students, a young woman who was a feminist, said, how come there are no, these seem to be all male world religious founders? Why aren't there any women? She's kind of mad at me. Happened to be, but I said I'll give you that to research, and then she found out that there was a earlier age of this Neolithic age, from about 10,000 to 3,000 BC, when the worship of the mother goddess was predominant religion in the in the world, and then that was replaced everywhere when sort of civilizations began with buildings and all these things, with a more male kind of deities. But so that there was an earlier female era, and a lot of books by feminists on that, and some might be more accurate than others. I can't get into that too much more right now. So, going on in the reading quote from the Rig Veda, neither gods nor mortals were made then, not night or day. Life was represented then by a solitary creative force. It was not a personal god, but an it, the creative force. So it's kind of speculations that resemble the Big Bang. And then the writer of this, no one knows who the writers of these were, who really knows? This is quoting from the Rig Veda. Who can here proclaim it? Whence was it born? Whence is this creation? The gods are later than this world's creation. These gods were created beings, so these 33 gods were later than the world's creation. That from which this creation came to being, whether created, twas or not created, he who is its overseer, here's a kind of beautiful statement, he who was its overseer, its in highest heavens, he only knows, or he may not. So, they weren't sure. So that is this, that from which this creation came into being, whether created, twas, or not created, he who was its overseer in the highest heaven, he only knows, or he may not. So, this is not as definitive as our book of Genesis, which was written by the ancient Hebrews. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and so on. After that, each succeeding hymn of the Rig Veda is intended for worship of one or more of the gods or devas, that these are superhuman beings. And they can be understood as personalized conceptions of natural powers, wind, the sky, fire, and also of human emotions like love, goddess of love, or god of war, and so forth. So here are a few of them. Vata, god of the wind, Ajna, god of fire, Parjana, god of rain, Surya, god of the sun, Usas, goddess of the dawn, and Indra, god of rain, and then later became the god of war, and Varuna, the sky god, and others. And here's a prayer to Usus, the goddess of the dawn. Meet out to us, O dawn, largesse, offspring, brave men, conspicuous wealth in cows and horses. This is not yet too spiritual or mystical. Okay. Now, of these various gods and goddesses, they differed in their moral qualities. Varuna was thought to be a mortal god of the sky, a very moral god, but Indra, the god of war, was not moral at all. So they have four Vedas, 33 gods and goddesses. Later, that's the Vedas, you have the Brahmanas beginning around 800 BC, period of the Vedas, 1500 to 1000 BC. Brahmanas are Vedic priests, created commentaries on the Vedas for education of the priesthood, and these were called Brahmanas. This is around 600 BC, and that's about the time of the Buddha came a little after that, and that was my lecture yesterday. How many attended the lecture on the Buddha? Two. Oh. Great. Okay. He was an Indian too, and responded to that, to the religion of that time, by developing his own religion. But now, around 600 BC, which is close to the time of the Buddha in India too, and Lao Tzu in China, and Socrates in Greece, came a whole new development in Hindu religion. The Vedic polytheistic religion at this time was already on the decline. More learned and enlightened people didn't take these gods and goddesses seriously as real beings, but just forces of nature. And they developed what is called the Upanishads. And the authors of these are not known, but these were mystics and sages who went off to meditate and pray and to discover the nature of God and reality. There are about 100, there are books, 100 Upanishads in all, but of them only 13 are accepted as sacred books by all Hindus, the Upanishads. Upanishad means sacred teaching. Upanishads means sacred teaching. And from the Upanishads come the basic metaphysical ideas and meditative disciplines that are that all Hindus pay respect to and some practice. So the Upanishads were the development of a philosophical and mystical quest by unknown sages who wrote these. There was no egotism in them because they didn't even put their names on them. And the period of the Upanishads is about 600 BC to 200 BC. And the great theme of the Upanishads is the discovery of the supreme being, the supreme source of all, and that which created all and is in all, and that is Brahman, Brahman, the essence of all things. The Brahman was mentioned in the earlier Vedas, but just the name and as one among many gods, but they didn't have the idea of one sacred reality then. So, then Brahman becomes the source from which all things spring, all of nature, the gods. So the gods can still exist. Mark, hi. We've gone past the Vedas and the polytheism of 33 gods to the discovery of the one God, or Brahman. And this is a God who is genuinely one without a second. There's no dualism in this form of Hinduism. He's one without a second. And so the various gods can exist too as various creations of Brahman, but they're not the supreme. So the 33 Vedic gods were reduced to only one, Brahman. Now that is similar to the developments from polytheism to monotheism by the Jews, the ancient Hebrews, Israelites, later called Jews, who they left polytheistic Mesopotamia and polytheistic Egypt and discovered the Yahweh, the one God. Here, no one left for anywhere. It was just a religious development. Here's a deep point. If Brahman is the basis of all things, from the gods to a drop of water, then it followed that Brahman was the fundamental reality of one's own self. Now some Christian mystics and talk about that. Meister Eckhart and Saint Bernard, and many others, but some forms of Christianity are dualistic. God up there, us here, so separate. This is non-dualistic. So this is if Brahman is the basis of all things, from the gods to a drop of water, it followed that Brahman was the fundamental reality of one's own self. So the way to seek and one's own self in the Hinduism of that time to now is Atman. So the inner or true self is Atman. Atman. A-T-M-A-N. So for the Hindu follower of the Upanishads, and they are interestingly enough called Vedantas, followers, that relates to Vedas, but you have Vedantic societies, and these are people who follow the Upanishads. The chief teaching is the Brahman, the universal being, the universal God, and then the way to know him is to go into your own deep self, your true self. So meditation. From the Isha Upanishad, here are some quotations. Whatever lives is full of the Lord, or Brahman. Claim nothing, enjoy, do not covet his property. So it wouldn't seem to favor private property. Do not covet his property. Then hope for 100 years of life doing your duty. No other way can prevent deeds from clinging, proud as you are of your human life. They that deny the Atman, the true self, return after death to a godless birth, blind, enveloped in darkness. They that deny the Atman, or the self, true self, return after death to a godless birth, blind, enveloped in darkness. That would apply to most modern psychology, which, except for perhaps Carl Jung, he had the idea of a greater self within. Most of them do not accept that. That's not scientific. Their God is science. And so the Upanishads say that. The self is one, this is Isha Upanishad. Unmoving, it moves faster than the mind. The senses lag, but self runs ahead. Unmoving, it outruns pursuit. Out of the self comes the breath that is the basis of all life. Still, quoting from the Isha Upanishad, the self is everywhere, without a body, without shape, whole, pure, wise, all-knowing, far-shining, self-depending, all-transcending, in the eternal procession assigning to every period its proper duty. Here's a prayer to Brahma. Holy light, illuminate the way that we may gather the good we planted. Are not our deeds known to you? Do not let us grow crooked. We are we that kneel and pray again and again. Here's this gives you some idea of in the Gospels, by the way, Jesus says the Father and I are one, and I suppose most Christians, except Christian mystics, think that only applies to Jesus, but for Hindus that applies to everyone. Brahman and Atman are one. The Atman is the sacred within you, and that's the self, or the Atman, not the ego, but the true self, and Brahma. From the Kina Upanishad, this is Atman and Brahman. That which makes the tongue speak, but needs no tongue to explain, that alone is spirit. That which makes the mind think, but needs no mind to think, that alone is spirit. That which makes the eye see, but needs no eye to see, that alone is spirit. That which makes life live, but needs no life to live, that alone is spirit. Spirit is known through revelation. It leads to freedom. So, I like that. That's from the Kina Upanishad. And then in the Katha Upanishad, this gives you the idea. God, the inmost self, lives in the heart. So this discovery of the Atman, or the self, and that the self is at one with the Brahman, that's the basic discovery of all of the Upanishads. And there are many dialogues in there. There's a dialogue in the Chandogya Upanishad between a father and a son, and the father tries again and again to teach the son, through various dialogues and teachings, that his own Atman, self, is at one with the Brahman, and the son each time fails to understand the teaching, and then finally he understands the teaching at the end. The Atman is, or Brahman is not knowable by perception, in turn inward or outward, nor by both combined. He is neither that which is known nor that which is not known, nor is he the sum of all that might be known. He cannot be seen, grasped, bargained with. He is undefinable, unthinkable, indescribable. That relates to the Tao Te Ching, where Lao Tzu in China defines the Tao, or doesn't define, says that the Tao that is nameable or understandable or definable is not the eternal God. So he is undefinable, unthinkable, indescribable. The only proof of his existence is union with him. The world disappears in him. He is the peaceful, the good, the one without a second. The one without a second. Now that is not in any way different than the Jewish teaching, which is also non-dualistic, if you understand. In Jewish prayers sometimes say, God is one and there is none else. So that somewhere dualism snuck into Christianity. It might be because St. Thomas Aquinas tried to kind of harmonize the Christian teachings with Aristotle. And this no comparison between Jewish teachings and Aristotelian philosophy. Here's a prayer from one of the Upanishads. You may have heard this. Lead me from the unreal to the real. Lead me from darkness to light. Lead me from death to immortality. Here's an interesting one. In the beginning, all things were self, in the shape of personality. He looked around, saw nothing but himself. The first thing he said was, "It is I." Hence, I became his name. Remember the revelation of I am that I am to Moses and the burning bush. Since I became his name. He is the eldest of all. Because he has destroyed evil, he is called the first person. He who knows this destroys all evil, takes the first rank. So the mystics of the Upanishads sought what Christians would call God union. And union. You've heard the term yoga, right? Yoga. And yoga means to yoke or to unite. And we know yoga as various physical postures, but that's only a very small part of yoga. They have basically four different yogas. Four yogas. Hinduism, in Buddhism, the only thing is to meditate, one yoga. But Hinduism has four yogas, and they are a jnana yoga, usually they spell it J-N-A-N-A, J-N-A-N-A, which is yoga of knowledge, that's a thinking yoga. And the some of the dialogues in the Upanishads are sort of a jnana yoga. They try to break through your mental blocks to suddenly have a realization of what God is. And that's thinking. So the philosophers, who are always thinkers, follow a jnana yoga. And that's a legitimate yoga if you're thinking. By the way, it corresponds exactly to Carl Jung's four types. He has a thinking, feeling, intuition, and sensation type. They didn't get it from Jung. Jung got it from them. So, it's jnana yoga. And then there's a raja yoga. Raja yoga is meditation. It's not thinking. Meditation isn't thinking, but is being quiet and contemplative. And that's the way of intuition, or raja yoga. Then, this is a unique teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God, comes a little later, is karma yoga, and that's action. It relates to sensation and yoga of action. And that means you could do anything, like dig ditches, or be a farmer, or a fisherman, or even a warrior. And in the Bhagavad Gita is about a warrior, Arjuna, and his charioteer, who happens to be God, Krishna. But anyway, karma yoga is action, except action without concern with its results. Action without concern for its rewards or punishments. Action for its own sake only. Another way of saying that is action devoted to God. So dishwashing and cooking could be a karma yoga. If you don't do it worrying about what the rewards will be, and you dedicate it to God, that is a very high form of yoga taught by the Hindus, karma yoga. Writing books, dancing, whatever it might be. If you don't worry about the results, it is karma yoga, and you dedicate it to God. And there's a book by called Brother Lawrence, called, I don't know what his century was, Christian monk, and maybe Dominican, I'm not sure, called The Practice of the Presence of God. And that he was the cook and dishwasher of his monastery, and he became a very enlightened and illumined man. And he wrote a little book called The Practice of the Presence of God, and it's exactly a Christian karma yoga. And they do a lot of karma yoga around here, so We have to do the dishes for them. So now with the small time remaining, that wasn't the last development of Hinduism. The Upanishads, as great as they are, the discovery of a universal God, the Brahman, and that he resides in the heart as Atman or the self, there was, if it ended there, it would be fairly similar to Orthodox Judaism, although some not identical, of course. But there was a new development, and that took place, and that is the that took place between 200 BC and 200 AD, which are, they don't know the exact dates, of two great poets, and one of them wrote the Mahabharata, and that is Vyasa, V-Y-A-S-A, Vyasa wrote an extraordinarily long book of poems, which told stories, called the Mahabharata, and one of the books of the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita, which means the Song of God, the Song of God. And the other book of that period, written by another poet named Valmiki, was the Ramayana. So this is a development that's somewhat analogous to the development of Christianity from Judaism, where you have an incarnation for Christians, that would be Jesus, the Christ. But for the Hindus, there were of this next development, there were said to be, they went from a kind of the Brahman, the One, to a Trinity, uninfluenced probably by Christianity, but they went from a One to a Trinity of, from Brahman, the Godhead, to Brahma, the Creator, Vishnu, the Sustainer, and Shiva, the Destroyer. Brahma, Creator, Vishnu, Sustainer, and Shiva, the Destroyer. And this was the development of a devotional Hinduism, as opposed to a more mystical Hinduism, a devotional one, with a personal God, and there were two different sects. One were worshippers of Shiva, the Destroyer. I won't talk too much about that. And then they had worshippers of Vishnu, the Sustainer, and from Vishnu, the Sustainer, that's one part of what we have in Christianity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Vishnu, from Vishnu came 10 incarnations of Vishnu, incarnations of God. And the seventh, the very early ones were animals, but the seventh one was Rama, and that's who the Ramayana by Valmiki is about. And he came long, thousands and thousands of years ago, Rama. There's no historical, Pastor Jim was asking me, well, what is the historical basis? I said, there is none. The Hindus and Buddha, well, Hindus were not interested in our concept of history. These are not historical, they're more, might say, more mythical than historical. Anyway, Ramayana, he was the seventh incarnation of Vishnu, and the eighth incarnation of Vishnu is Krishna. And curiously, the name, Krishna, both in the Sanskrit and Christos in Greek, come from the same Indo-European root, Kris. What the meaning of that is, I can't explain. But Krishna, whose name resembles somewhat Christ, was the eighth incarnation of Vishnu. And So this new development of Hinduism, which was in the same general time period, as the development of Christianity, was devotional, and they worshipped a god in the form of Krishna, if they were followers of the Vishnu sect, and they even thought of Krishna as even higher than Brahman, the Absolute. He came from the Absolute, but then he is even sort of supersedes the Absolute, somewhat like Christ becomes the center of worship in Christianity, and you sort of forget about the Absolute. I am, I am. Anyway, so the Bhagavad Gita starts with a battlefield scene where Arjuna, the warrior, is on the battlefield in a chariot, and he has a charioteer. His charioteer happens to be Krishna, the eighth incarnation of God. And he has, it's a battle between various kinfolk, and the other side is a really evil bunch, but Arjuna has become kind of very discouraged about this fighting, and doesn't want to fight anymore. And let me quote from that in my book. Here's Arjuna. Krishna, Krishna, now as I look on these kinsmen arrayed for battle, my limbs are weakened, my mouth is parching, my body trembles, my hair stands upright, my skin seems burning, the bow Gandiva slips from my hand, my brain is whirling round and round, I can stand no longer. Krishna, I see such omens of evil. What can we hope from this killing of kinsmen? What do I want with victory, empire, of their enjoyment? O Govinda, how can I care for power or pleasure, my own life even, when all these others, teachers, fathers, grandfathers, uncles, sons and brothers, husbands of sisters, grandsons and cousins, for whose sake only I could enjoy them, stand here ready to risk blood and wealth in war against us? Nor of all things, though they should slay me, how could I harm them? I cannot wish it. Never, never, not through, though it won me the throne of three worlds, how much the less for earthly kinship. Krishna, hearing the prayers of all men, tell me, how can we hope to be happy slaying the sons of Dhritarashtra, evil though they may be, worst of the wicked, yet if we kill them, our sin is greater. How could we dare spill the blood that unites us? Where is the joy in killing of kinsmen? Arjuna goes on in his discourse for some verses and ends up saying, he shall not struggle, he shall not fight, and will not let the enemy, will not slay the enemy. Having spoke thusly, Arjuna threw aside his arrows and his bow in the midst of the battlefield. Now, do you think that Krishna will counsel him to give up the fight or to fight? Well, okay. To fight is correct. Some people see the simple-minded view, see the Bhagavad Gita as sort of pro-war and anti-pacifist. That's not true at all. This is all symbolic, mythical, symbolic kind of level, and it has to do with going on with his life, with his karma duty, and his karma duty is that of a warrior. The people he's fighting are pretty evil anyway. So this is, Krishna says this to Arjuna. Arjuna, is this hour of battle the time for scruples and fancies? Are they worthy of you who seek enlightenment? Any brave man who merely hopes for fame or heaven would despise them. What is this weakness? It is beneath you. Is it for nothing men call you the folk consumer? Shake off this cowardice, Arjuna. Stand up. Arjuna goes on in his protest against taking action. He disguises his despondency as compassion. Which will be worse, to win this war or lose? I can scarcely know. Even the sons of Dhritar Rashtra stand in the enemy ranks. If we kill them, none of us will wish to live. But then he sees through his alleged compassion and says, Arjuna admits, is this real compassion I feel or only a delusion? My mind gropes about in darkness. I cannot see where my duty lies, Krishna. I beg you, tell me frankly and clearly what I ought to do. I am your disciple. I put myself in your hands. Show me the way. And then he puts himself in the traditional guru-disciple relationship to Krishna. He has a very high guru, God himself incarnate as Krishna. And then Krishna goes on to teach him the four yogas, and he begins with the Jnana Yoga, and he says, your words are wise, Arjuna, but your sorrow is for nothing. The truly wise mourn neither the living nor the dead. He gives the idea of the immortality of the self. There was never a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor any of these kings, nor is there any future in which we will cease to be. Just as the dwellers in this body pass through childhood, youth, and old age, so at death he merely passes into another kind of body. The wise are not deceived by that. And he's teaching Arjuna the doctrine from the Upanishads of the Atman, and which is at one with the Brahman. Then he goes on to teach Arjuna, we may go a little over if that's okay, Arjuna the Karma Yoga, and he says this, you have the right to work, but for the work's sake only. You have no right to the fruits of the work. It doesn't mean you shouldn't get paid, but you shouldn't worry about it. Desire, I can't say that I live up to this. I don't. You know, very few do. I have problems with my publisher, etc., etc. But if I was truly following this, I would just be writing not concerned with when royalties were going to be paid or how much. Anyway, desire for the fruits of work must never be your motive in working. He says, in the calm of self-surrender, you can free yourself from the bondage of virtue and vice during this very life. Devote yourself, therefore, to reaching union with Brahman. Further on the Karma Yoga, work done with anxiety about results is far inferior to work done without such anxiety. In the calm of self-surrender, seek refuge in the knowledge of Brahman. They who work selfishly for results are miserable. So we have the, he taught him, or there's a lot in there of dialogues, the Jnana Yoga, Yoga of Knowledge, and Karma Yoga applies to him, because he is a warrior type, and being a warrior, and this happens to be a just war against a really evil other side. There was a movie on this called the Mahabharata that the pastor said he saw. I saw part of it, and it shows how monstrous the other side were. But anyway, that is his karma yoga that he's called upon to do, and then Krishna teaches him the Raja Yoga, teaches him to how to sit in a secluded place, make a pile of grass, put over that deer skin, and then meditate, concentrating only on the Atman, and that is the Raja Yoga, and that is really identical to Buddhism, like Zen Buddhism, which practices meditation. That's could be called a form of Raja Yoga. And finally, he teaches him at the end Bhakti Yoga, which is the yoga of devotion or worship. And he said these other yogas are pretty hard, the Jnana Yoga, the philosopher, Raja Yoga, a monk or mystic. The Karma Yoga is a very good one anyone could practice. And then there's the yoga of worship or Bhakti Yoga. And that, Krishna teaches, is the easiest yoga, but it will just as surely lead to God. Let me read you a little bit of that. Bhakti Yoga. Okay. A bhakti yogi will worship God in the form of Krishna. An ordinary Christian will worship God in the form of Christ. An ordinary Jew will worship God by practicing what it says in the Torah about loving God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. The ordinary Muslim also practices a devotional form of religion, which involves daily prayer and worship. And so the Krishna says this, quickly I come to those who offer me every action, worship me only, their dearest delight, with devotion undaunted. Because they love me, these are my bondsmen, and I shall save them from mortal sorrow and all the waves of life's deathly ocean. Be absorbed in me, lodge your mind in me, thus you shall dwell in me, do not doubt it, here and forever. So he teaches the yoga of devotion, of the bhakti yoga. And Krishna summarizes his four ways to Arjuna. Some whose hearts are purified realize the Atman within themselves through contemplation, the Raja Yoga. Some realize the Atman philosophically by meditating upon its independence of Prakriti. Prakriti, I don't know what Prakriti is, but anyway, that's the Jnana Yoga. Others realize it by following the yoga of right action. Others do not know these paths, worship God as their teachers have taught them. If these faithfully practice what they have learned, they will also pass beyond death's power. In the Bhagavad Gita, we'll end up with this, Arjuna asks, well, Krishna first, this dialogue here is about Krishna as God immanent, immanence of God. And we can read a little of this. The Blessed Lord said, this is from chapter 10 of the Bhagavad Gita, come then, and I will explain to you at least the chief ones which transcend of my pervading powers, because unbounded I extend. In the heart of every being, I am the soul installed to dwell, the origin and midst of beings. I am also their end as well. I am Vishnu of the sky gods, the radiant sun among the lights. I am Maharishi of the storm gods. I am the moon of stars at nights. I am Indra among the deities, and the Sama of the Vedas taught. I am mind among the senses, and among the beings I am thought. I am Shiva of destroyers, the lord of wealth of sprites and freaks. I am fire among the brilliant, and Muru of the mountain peaks. I am chief among the priests, their god Brihaspati is me. I am the god of war of captains, among the waters I am the sea. I am Rigu of great sages of words of single syllable. I am the murmured prayer of worship, Himalaya of things immovable. I am Ganges of the rivers. I am the wind of purifiers, Leviathan of water monsters. I am Rama of the warriors, the beginning of creation. I am the end and middle too, of sciences and sciences of the soul. In disputation, I am true. I am the letter A of letters, Alpha, and of compounded words, the pair. I am truly an immortal time, the ordainer facing everywhere. I am death that carries away the origin of things to be, and female nouns, fame, wisdom, speech, luck, firmness, patience, memory. I am Gayatri of meters, the greatest chant of those men say. I am the first amid the months and of the seasons. I am spring. I am conquest, resolution, the dice of those who speculate. I am the goodness in the great good. I am the greatness in the great. I am the craft of would-be rulers. I am the rod which men chastise. I am the silence of the secret. I am the wisdom of the wise. I am whatever is the seed in every other kind of being. Without me, nothing could exist. Not one unmoved. I have a misspelling there. Or something being. So my divine pervading powers, as I have said, can never end. In these examples, I have declared how my pervading powers extend. Whatever shows pervading powers in either majesty or might, be sure it springs in every case from just a part of my own life. Yet, what's the use for you to know so much of this extensive flow? Since, misspelling, all of the cosmos I sustain, with parts of me yet full remain. So, That is Krishna revealing his immanence in all things. And there, in the Gospel of John, there's Jesus makes a lot of series of I am statements that is similar to that. One of them I like very much is when the Pharisee came to Jesus and said, how can a man younger than 50 know things like you say? He said, well, and claim identity or something with Abraham. Jesus said, before Abraham even was, I am. So in any event, that is a little bit about Hinduism and the devotional stage of the incarnate God Krishna was the last stage of development in Hinduism. Hinduism, since with its series of incarnations, is extremely the most tolerant of religions, and since Krishna takes the eighth place, many Hindus assume that the Buddha was the ninth incarnation of Vishnu. And when they discovered Jesus and Christianity in the Gospels, he seems to fit the tenth incarnation. They have forms of the Gospel written in the form of the Bhagavad Gita in India. So they would not have trouble with other incarnations of Vishnu, but Christianity is sort of more exclusive than Hinduism. So I can't say that I understand how and why religion, both the Judaism to Christianity and the earlier form of Hinduism to the later. I can't explain that, but there seems to be a development toward the incarnational.